I've just been given the thumbs up, which means it's time for me to start. Welcome to my talk on, well, called From Start to REST. It's all about the ASP.NET Web API and how it enables you to do REST APIs. I'm not going to talk too much about the details of REST itself, or, you know, kind of espouse the theories that Roy, I think it was Feldman, his dissertation on REST and all that kind of stuff. We're going to talk about the basic principles, and I guess how the ASP.NET Web API allows you to achieve those. So that's about all for the slides that I have for you today. Thanks for coming. Just joking. Just a few things before I get going. I don't know if anybody doesn't know me. My name's Paul Glavich. I'm currently the CTO of Sasu, which is an online accounting application. Also an ASP.NET MVP, book author, and a few other less relevant things. Excuse me. When I started to come up with this presentation, I started doing a few PowerPoints and then writing up some code and JavaScript to access a web API and then go back a few more slides. And it was kind of becoming a bit disjointed, so I thought, well, bugger the slides, they're kind of boring. I'll just do the whole thing as an MVC4 application. Everything's jQuery and JavaScript up front, and everything's backed by the web API. So it's completely code-driven. All the code will be available for download, or is currently available for download. I'll give you a link at the end of this presentation. But also, I don't know if many of you attended the talks on Azure websites. I have pushed this code using the Git integration up to an Azure website, so you can actually follow along with the demo, or you can pretty much go straight to the end if you like. It's entirely up to you. There's the URL. Some of the demos that are up there probably won't make sense because you'll see something happen. It won't be clear as to what goes on in the background. There's a few things that don't quite work up in Azure websites with this demo, things like self-hosting that require extra ports to be opened. But for the most part, it's all up there so you can bounce along. And also, you know, if you get to the very end, it's also got all the slide resources and everything, so you don't actually have to write it down. So just in terms of agenda, we're just going to give a bit of a brief history as to how we got to the Web API, because there's been a few permutations and incarnations up to this point. Again, some of the basic principles of REST, how the Web API is going to allow us to achieve those. And then we're going to do a flyby of all the features, how you can do something in the Web API, kind of how it looks in code, and then we're going to move on to the next feature. So we're going to go through a lot, and there's going to be a whole sort of bouncing around of features, and hopefully it's nice and cohesive for you, so it's quite understandable. But we are going to cover a lot, so it's going to seem as if I'm speeding through a little bit. But I will be available for questions after and in the speaker lounge. And then finally, obviously, we're going to wrap up as you sit there in complete astonishment at how wonderful everything is. So first up, back in the start of .NET, we had the ASMX web service, the original .NET web service. It was cool. It worked. Spewed out some XML, took in some XML. It was easy to generate proxies. You know, that was kind of the beginning of web services. It was pretty cool because, like I said, it was fairly simple and it worked. And that concept of simplicity is kind of what's come around with us today with REST. But it had its shortcomings, most notably security, and there's a whole bunch of other messaging aspects that go along with its shortcomings, but security was a predominant one. So out of that was born the Web Service Enhancements, the WSE, versions 1, 2, and 3, affectionately known as WSE. So we had WSE 1, 2, and 3. And they started to form up the WS security specification and how sort of all the SOAP packets are formed nowadays. And, you know, back in the early days, because it was so early, not only was the XML quite verbose, it was mind-numbingly complex and pretty hard to implement, but it was there, it was the first steps. And then along came WCF, which pretty much does implement pretty much all the WS standards, so it was WS freaking everything. It does quite a lot. It's a really powerful library, but, you know, a lot of people still had a lot of trouble with it. The configuration was somewhat complex. It was really weird in some places, how to configure one thing that was done a bit differently than the other. And it wasn't so easy to implement REST APIs. You could do it. You just have to sort of do a bit of black magic with configuration and attributes and attributes on interfaces and making sure all the stuff is correct. So a lot of people still weren't happy. As a result of that, we've got this fantastic MVC framework. And people were just using custom views and writing a bit of code in the back end to spit out some XML or JSON using MVC. And that was surprisingly simple, really easy to implement. And it was actually probably, I don't know, on the same level of complexity, maybe in some ways simpler to implement than the WCF equivalent. And so this was gaining a lot of traction. As that was going along, the WCF Web API project was going along on Codeblex, and that was a way to try and make WCF a much nicer REST citizen, a much easier way to produce REST APIs. Still very WCF-ish. You had to have your interface contracts and attribute on that, and then implement that interface and do a few other bindings and chunky stuff like that. And it was coming along okay, but they were, you know, the team was looking at all this MVC stuff going on and think, geez, these guys are making a fairly easy REST API using MVC. You know, and our stuff, while there's some really good features with it, we want it to be that easy as well. So they've kind of said, right, well, we're going to can the WCF Web API, but we're going to take all the good bits from that and take the good bits with how you're producing REST APIs and MVC, and we're going to join those together, and that's what we got with the ASP.NET Web API today. So if you actually have a look on Codeplex or do a Google search, you'll probably see some remnants of WCF Web API, but you know, that's just for historical reasons. So REST, just very quickly, I guess. You know, it's a kind of a known quantity. It's all about HTTP and using what's available. It's simple in that because it is known. Everybody's using it. It's, you know, it's the default flavor of the internet. And because of that, you know, everybody starts to implement it based off these REST principles. It's easy to consume. So it's kind of generally the winner. If you ever try to consume a, you know, WCF service using you know, complex SOAP or WS security from anyone other than a .NET client, and it's usually quite tricky. So REST is just consumable by everyone. It's perfect for public APIs. WCF is still good for WCF is still good for REST APIs, but it's more sort of behind the web servers, for example, using enterprises where you want guaranteed delivery, perhaps message throttling, all that kind of stuff. So REST, use what's available. HTTP content types, you know, SSL, status code, all the stuff you already know about today. JSON and XML are the favored few when it comes to payloads. JSON more so now than XML because it's simply quite verbose. And ASP.NET Web API supports JSON and XML out of the box, in addition to supporting all status returning of status codes in a nice, easy-to-use manner. Excuse me. Resource-based. So this is another REST concept where you might have, you see on the screen, we've got HTTP host contact 1. So you've got a resource there. That one is, if you issue a HTTP GET, it'll get contact 1. If you issue a HTTP PUT or POST, it might save the details of contact 1. If you issue a HTTP DELETE, it will delete contact number 1. So you've got one URL, multiple actions, with the actions inferred from the HTTP action themselves. Now the shying away, well, the advocates are saying, you know, you should, that's the approach you should take. You shouldn't necessarily do a noun then verb as in, you know, HTTP host contact GET 1 to get number 1 and DELETE 1 to delete number 1. But there's no reason you can't do that. I mean, that's really up to you. But again, you know, the advocates with the tinfoil hats are saying that the resource-based one is the way to go. And ASP.NET Web API supports that out of the box as well, so it makes it quite easy for you. Just final concept number 4, I don't know how you pronounce it, HTOS or something, is simply around hypermedia as the engine of application state. And it's kind of a long-winded way of saying, well, when I make a REST API call and get a response, in that response, I've got everything to tell me what else I can do and what other resources are available. Might provide extra links, extra resourcing, some documentation around that. It's pretty early in the days of this kind of concept for formal support. There's a few libraries that I've got listed here that are extensions to the Web API that you can kind of whack on there and it will give you this kind of support. It does require a little extra work. Like I said, it is quite early. It's extremely nice way of doing things, but there's not a lot of people who are doing it currently nor taking advantage of it currently. So it's something to keep an eye on and perhaps implement if you can. But, you know, it's a value thing. Just some of the basics before we jump into a quick demo and code. So it is very MVC-ish. It is, however, separate from MVC. It has no ties to MVC whatsoever. We'll see a lot of what appears to be duplication as we go ahead. And they've, again, almost identical concepts between Web API and MVC. The team made a conscious decision to not take any dependencies on MVC. However, a lot of the concepts are MVC, from MVC are in Web API, so it looks almost identical. You think, well, why the hell is this duplication? It's simply because they did not want a dependency on MVC. And that'll become more apparent as time goes on. You'll see why this dependency makes sense. Controllers inherit from API controller instead of a controller. That's pretty easy. Everything's stored in this global configuration object, and there's a whole raft load of configuration elements from that, but it's this one initial static property that you can access a lot of your stuff from. By default, when you create a new project, it'll default to something like HTTP, your host, API, and then your API controller, and we'll have a look at that in the demo in a second, but it's easily changeable. Again, we talked about this before. HTTP method is inferred from controller actions. So in your controller, if you've got get junk or put junk, the web API will say, well, if you've got a get in front of it, that means this is going to serve as a HTTP get. If you've got a put in front of it, it's going to serve as a HTTP put. So it kind of infers what the HTTP action is that it redirects it to just from the name of the method. You can explicitly put attributes on there if you like, but it tries its hardest to work out where it should go, gentlemen, where it should go, and it kind of does that for you. So it reduces the amount of code and mapping and attributes that you need to have in there. It's quite nice. CONNEG, or content negotiation. Again, out of the box, you'll get JSON and XML. So if you pass in your request, in your accept header, you've got, you know, application JSON, or text XML or whatever, it'll say, oh, well, you want one of those. I'll go and format the response as that and give it back to you. You don't really have to do anything. You can remove the default content types from the framework. You can insert your own. It's really quite flexible. You can set a different one as a default and one as a fallback. It's very easy to change around. Interception points, dependency injection, handlers, everything's async. If you're familiar with the tasks library, it's everywhere in Web API, so everything is done with tasks and continuations. It's very deep support for async actions, and the reason for that is they want high scalability out of it. And we'll see a short demo on that a bit later on. So without any ado, we'll jump into some code. Now these demos are going to be fairly basic, and they're more so. Can you guys see that? Okay. They're more so just to demonstrate how Web API kind of works out the routing for you and gets it into your methods. So what I'm going to hear, all I'm executing here is we're going to my localhost /API/simple. So if I do that in my controller here, which implements API controller. I've got my get method. It's not really decorated any particular way, but it's executed HTTP get, and it's going to return that for me, and that's all good. If we go down here, you can see I've executed API simple. It was a get. Okay, nothing too spectacular about that. If I'm going to pass in a parameter, so I've got, again, API simple, but this time I'm going to have a query string parameter of ID equals something. So I'll go one, blah, blah, blah. Pass that one in. I've got another method here of get, but this one's taking in that int ID, so it matches up with the query string parameter. The Web API has routed that there for me. Again, if I have a look at that. So there's a query. And by the way, in terms of the client-side code, if you're familiar with jQuery, it's just doing $.ajax. There's really nothing special there. So I'm not going to dive into that too much because it's fairly boring. But I've just provided a query parameter on that. And the Web API said, cool, I've matched it up with that query parameter. I'm going to whack it in there for you. And again, if I'm passing in a text parameter, this one's got a some text query string parameter. You can see that it gets in there. And that's all good. Have a look at the query. Again, we're just still executing HTTP gets here. So we're just changing the query parameters, and it's being smart enough to route it in there for us. We don't have to do anything special. Actually, if I just jump quickly into the global ASAX. Okay. So this is what it does by default for you. So this is the original route. It's done a map HTTP route, which is web API specific. You'll see down here that because it's MVC application, it's also done a map route. So we've got the MVC part of it. But here's our default implementation for web API. So this is one map HTTP route. However, in the next example here, I'm going to go to host beer kind of beer. So I'm not going to, not explicitly saying I'm going to the simple controller. So I like to have strong beer. Execute that. And that's been diverted to the get me some beer. And in kind of beer, I've got strong. Okay, that's all good. The URL for that is beer strong. So it's a little bit different. And the way we did that, again, if I go down here, I've set up another specific HTTP route to say beer, kind of beer, is going to control a simple action, get me some beer. So again, very MVC-esque. But we've just got a different way of specifying. We're specifying the map HTTP route. However, for posts and heads and puts and deletes and those kinds of things, so I'm going to put some arguments in there, and I'm going to execute a post. Now, if we have a look at this, I've actually got an object here. If I just quickly jump into that object, it's just very simple. I've just got public string arg1, arg2, arg3. Nothing spectacular about that. If I go back up here, have a look at the data. You can see that there's data populated in there. That's all good. If I have a look at the client itself, again, we're going against that same URI, so API simple, but we have executed a post. And if I go down and look at the body, the request payload is just that JSON object. So those parameters match those parameters in that object that you saw, and the web API is smart enough to stuff that in there for us. So we haven't had to do any mapping or anything like that. And in addition, because it was a post, it routed it to the correct method. If I do the same with a put, it's routed it to my put junk method for me. Again, haven't had to do anything, just executing a HTTP put, and it's filled up our data structure for us as well. Just so that I'm not lying, there's a put there. So again, same URI. So all I'm doing is defining action methods. So it's pretty easy. All I'm doing, and prefixing that, and that sort of gives the web API enough information to tell it where to go in a nice way. Finally, HTTP head. I've got a method called head of cat herding, but because it's prefixed with head, it passed it off to this method for us, which is all good. If we have a look at the URI, again, it's off to API simple. Oh, excuse my hands. And it's a head request. So that all comes for free. But what if we didn't want that kind of behavior? You know, we're sort of doing all the multiple methods. Maybe we want something a bit more generic. We want to deal with it, the object itself or the request and the response itself. So I'm going to go over to this host generic controller. And let's just execute that first. So I'll do that. And if we have a look at this one, it's post generic. So I'm actually doing a post to get there. I'm taking in a HTTP request message, and I'm returning a HTTP response message. And there's a whole bunch of things you can do. You know, in this particular simplistic instance, I'm getting the body, and I'm using the Newtonsoft JSON library to extract some items from it and return form up a string. And then from the request, I'm going to create a response. It's going to contain a string of a status code OK, which is 200, and then I'm going to return a string format of some, you know, rubbish info. But before it gets there, I'm going to say from the response, I'm going to add some headers. So web server, web one, glow is bald, and age, you know, time span from seconds is 60. So we'll let that run through. We get a response back from it. Again, you can see that we're hitting API generic and post. And actually, if I have to scroll it down a bit, look at the response headers. You see the request payload there. The age is 60. We've got Glover's ball. And web server, web one. So we're interacting with some of the raw response. It's allowed us some you know, detailed interaction with the request and the response. So you don't necessarily have to just use that, you know, prefixing of action methods. You can do it with the raw message itself. Okay, so a lot of that, again, is an ease of use thing. It's about trying to make your action methods quite clean and easy to understand, so that way it's nice and maintainable, easy to implement. Now we've got a couple of ways that the Web API tries to get information into your parameters for your action methods. We've got model binding, there's media formatting, which are specific to content types or media types. And there's a few rules that Web API follows. So when I say model binding, it is the same type of stuff as MVC, but again, it's still distinctly separate, but exactly the same concept. So simple types, like we saw in that last demo, we've got ID equals 123, or a simple object that just has simple string properties. They generally use model binding. And in the same way, a similar way to MVC, we'll use these value providers to try and get it from the URI or from the body. And the Web API, as we've already seen, does a reasonable job of working it out, even when it's it's just a simple object. Complex types, so say we've got an object with some string fields, but in that we've got another list of string and complex objects like that. It generally defers to using media formatters. So it looks for a particular media format. So if you've got a content type of application/foobar, it'll look for some media formatter associated with that and try and deserialize that object to put it into your action methods. It's all about getting nice action methods for you. You can change where the Web API gets this information from. If you mandate that it comes from a particular place, such as the URI, so it's a from URI attribute or the from body attribute, so you can place that on your action parameters or on your model objects. And that'll sort of give hints to the Web API as to what to do. One of the important concepts with the Web API, and we're going to look at this in a demo soon, is that the message body can be read only once. If you're dealing with model binding, you don't really have to worry about it because the Web API takes copies of the message body and shuffles it into the parameters for you. When you're dealing with a thing called delegating handles or fairly early up in the pipeline, if you read the body and you don't take a copy of it and do the right thing, when it gets down to your action methods, nothing will be there. And they've done that for basically for optimization. They don't want to make assumptions and make copies of the body all over the place just in case it's too large, and they want you to make an explicit decision around how to deal with that. I guess as a result of that, if you have got two complex types as action parameters, one must use model binding. So you need to mark it with a model binder and what model binder to use or vice versa. You've kind of got to, because it wants... If you've got two complex types, there can only really be one content type, and so it doesn't know which media formatter to use from that, and things can go astray. So one needs to use model binding, you need to use attributes to try to get around that. But we'll look at all that, it'll make a bit more sense soon when I delve into the code. But that's all getting the data into your action methods as variables. There are these things called delegating handlers, which are further up the pipeline, which intercept every single request. And so they can be used for, all cross-cutting concerns or doing things that are common across all requests, which might be usage logging or some form of authentication. They're not really concerned with, although they could be if you write the code, not really concerned with the content type, whether it's JSON or not. They don't care too much. They just get invoked regardless. And then further down the chain, we've spoken about media formatters. So you might we've got media formatters to read, JSON objects and XML objects. You can create a custom media formatter to read any content type. And we'll have a look at how to do that later on. It sounds a bit complex, but it's not very hard at all. Everything is registered in this global configuration object. All your message handlers, all your binders, everything is registered through this global configuration. Again, we'll have a look at that in a second. So what I've got is I'm going to pass a content type of application x dodgy, and the data it's going to post down is this. It's pretty much, it's custom data. It's not very nice. It might be coming from some legacy system. It's kind of a trivial example, but it's not something that the Web API could easily work out what to do with. And in this contrived example, the idea is it's going to have a name of test, Attribute 1 is going to be Joe, and attribute 2 is going to be Bodgy. And before we run that, let's just step up, go from the beginning, and see how it's working. So, global configuration format is add my Dodgy Media formatter. If I can have a look at that. My Dodgy Media formatter is just inheriting from Media formatter, and I'm defining a media type of application X Dodgy, which is what I'm going to pass down via the JavaScript AJAX call. And I'm just adding that to a supported media type so that it says, all right, well, if I get that, I know I can handle it. I'm overriding just a few methods. Can I read the type? Yeah, I can. I'm going to do some reading of that content. Can I write it? In this instance, no. I'm not going to write back any dodgy content. It's all going to be awesome content. Finally, I'm going to override this read from stream async. And you'll notice here it's returning a task of object. You'll see that all over the place in the web API. And I pass in a few options. We've got type, read stream, the HTTP content, and the formatter logger. But all I'm going to do, I'm going to say, all right, if the type on my action method is not of type dodgy model, then I'll throw a format exception because that's what I'm expecting. And then I'm going to go through, I'm creating a new dodgy model, and all I'm doing from the stream that comes in is I convert it to a string, and then I'm just doing some basic text manipulation and stripping out the pipe, splitting the pipe character to make it into a nice object. My dodgy model is just going to hold a name and a list of attributes. Where'd you go? So I've new it up, pass the string contents, and then I return the model. And then that will eventually get into my... So this all happens before it goes into the action method. So if I go back to here, and so I'm going to invoke my custom media formula. You can see it's in here. It's going to go through, it's going to pick out the text content. And you probably can't see that too well at the moment, but it's exactly what you saw on the screen up there. And then it's just going to go through and split it all out. Finally get to down here, and it's created a nice object for me, a nice structured object. If I let that run through, it finally gets into my custom binding controller, accepting a post of this dodgy model, and my dodgy model is now populated in a nice way with that string that's been extracted. Okay, so I've taken a fairly unstructured string, which is this, use a custom media formatter based on this media type, or content type, sorry, and created a nice object from it for our action method to deal with. Now, that's the media format. So we're stepping back up the chain now, and we're going to look at a delegating handler which sits prior to that in the chain. So again, like pretty much everything, it's fairly consistent. If I go to global ASAX, and my global configuration, I've got a message handler, and I'm adding my API usage logger. My API usage logger is inheriting from delegating handler and overriding one method. And again, you see a task of HTTP response messages being returned. So the web API is again using all this task-based semantics. Overriding my send async, taking in the request, and also a cancellation token. And all I'm doing in here, nothing special, I'm extracting some logging information, which is going to increment usage count for what kind of method we're using, what the URL is. It's going to add that into a case, as later on I'm going to display it on the screen. It executes that request, so we get a response. And from that response, we're going to add a continuation with a response message, and I'm going to extract the response logging information from that and return the response. Okay, so if I run that now, so if I get the site stats, and I've been, executing HTTP posts and gets and all that, so there'll be some stats there at the moment. So you can see how many URLs we've hit and how many times and the HTTP methods used. If I go into my... Actually, I'll put a breakpoint just to verify that I'm not lying. So if I invoke my custom media formatter, The first thing that's getting hit is my API usage logger, and then eventually gets into the media formatter, and down the pipe she goes. Okay, I did mention before that you can only read the message body once. So if I take that breakpoint off, and let me just stop debugging here for a second. So what I'm going to do here is create a memory stream, and from the request content, I'm going to do a copy to async. And once that's done, I'm going to read that mem stream and grab the content out of it, and I'm going to do something with it. It might be write to a database. But basically, I'm just getting the content out and copying it asynchronously to the stream, and then with a continuation, I'm using a stream reader to get that out. So just put a breakpoint on there. Let me just run that up. So what I'm going to do here is just demonstrate that concept around reading the message body only once. Okay, so we've got that. That's all very good. If I go back to, let's say, there's that one. This initial demo. Let's do a post, that post demo again. So I'll post data down the pipe. Okay, it's got into our delegating handler, our usage logger. It's got to the point where it's going to read out that data. It's all good. Now we're in the post data here, and you see that the data itself is actually null. There's nothing there. Even though it's essentially the same request as what we did before. We've got nothing. Nada. What you need to do, and that's obviously one of the traps. So if you were to do that and think, oh, cool, I've logged the information, it's in my database, everything's cool, but when it gets to the method, there's nothing there. What the hell's going on? So what you need to do, so take that stupid thing off. Okay, so what I'm doing here is before I do the copy to async, I'm actually just doing a load into buffer async, and then another continuation, then I do the same thing inside that. So I'm explicitly telling the web API to say, hey, I'm going to do something with the body, take a copy of it while I do some stuff with it. So let me just do that, just to verify that I'm not lying. When I was first working with the web API, I thought, beauty, I'm going to come up with a nice usage logger and everything will be good. And I did run into this problem. So now if I put this same post request, it's into our delegating handler, which is all good. And if we have a look at our data's still null. That's not really what I was hoping for. Let's see what we've done wrong here. Oh, of course. Okay, now we're back. Okay, so I've executed the post and now we've got the data in there even though that we're actually logging. So, just something to be aware of if you do happen to do that. Let me just take that off. And it's only really important if you use that delegating handler fairly up in the stream, fairly early up in the stream. Okay. So onto model binding. So we looked at delegating handlers, which was quite early up. We've got custom media formatters, which I wouldn't think that you'd use that often unless you've obviously got a custom media type that you want to deal with. For the most part, it'll probably be model binding, where you're sending just data down in JSON format, and it might be some sort of weird format that you want to put into one of your custom objects. So there's a few ways of doing it. You can do the attribute way. You can say, all right, well, as you can see, a model binder, type of model binder on your action parameters to say what kind of model binder you want to use to make your or populate your object. You can register a model binder provider, which then will instantiate or model binder to put that data into your object, and that's actually the preferred method as recommended by the ASP.NET team. Apparently, and this is so I've been told, the provider way of doing things is how they're moving to in terms of this kind of interception point, and MVC will be doing the same as well. If you want to get really hairy, you can create an instance of an iController configuration, so you implement that interface, and that'll give you per controller control over binders and formatters. So if you've just got a specific controller in your API that you want special behaviour with, you can implement that interface. You can have a low degree of control, a high degree of control over what's coming in. It's a bit of a low-level interface, though. For this example, we're going to use a model binder provider to provide a model binder to get some data into our action variables. And I know it all sounds a bit hairy, but it's actually pretty good, or pretty easy. So what I've got, actually, I'll just execute the method. So I'm going to API model binder, execute that. Let's go through that first. So what I'm doing is I've got a few get methods with this paging info. If I have a look at the paging info, I've got page, page size, and a list of string of sort fields. And I want, if there's something that's, if there's some paging related information on the incoming request, I want it to put into a nice paging info object for me so that I can play with it and do with it and do whatever I want with it. So actually I'll just run that again. So if I execute that, apologies for bouncing around. We'll go for the beginning again where that model binder provider is registered, and then we'll sort of work up the stack. So when I'm registering my dependency injection, I'm using ninject in this instance. And all I'm saying is bind my model provider, custom my GLADS model binder provider, which is my custom one, to the object of type model binder provider. So when the web API ask the dependency resolver, hey, give me a model binder provider, it actually gets my one in there. If I look at that, my model binder provider implements model binder provider, and all it does is override the get binder method, and one of the parameters it passes in model type, I say, well, all right, if there's a paging info on that action method, then I'm going to return back an instance of my paging info model binder. And what that does is implements iModel binder and implements the bind model method. And so what it's going to then do is one of the parameters it gets is binding context. Again, this is very similar to MVC. It uses the get value to look for the page parameter, the page size parameter, and the sort fields. And the sort fields are going to come in a pipe delimited format, so it's just going to do a string split and make them into a nice object. So it creates a new paging info, passes the string, populates its values, and then sets the binding context model to our bound model that we've created, returns true to say everything's good. So if I go back to this example again, execute that, which has got nothing on the URI. It's come into our bind model, we sort of work down. It hasn't found any strings, so we're just going to populate with defaults. Similar with the sort fields. Gets down here, and our model here has a page 1, page size 25. Finally gets into our action method, and we have a nice object in there that's populated with a set of defaults. That's all okay. And just to prove to you that it's not doing anything special, if I call up that, execute that again. Where'd you go? Oh, sorry. So again, we're just executing that, doing a straight get. Nothing spectacular, it's just populating the paging info with defaults. Now we're going to put a page equals 2, page size equals 40 on there. It goes into our model binder. It gets back to our get method, and we have a look at our paging info. We've got 2, 40, and the sort fields actually has a count of 2, so it's a nice structured list of sort fields. If we have a look at the URI for that, There it is up there. You can see where we've got page equals 2, page size equals 40, sort fields equals name, pipe age. So it's managed to pick out all that information, make into a nice structured .NET object for us, which is kind of nice. Finally, we get paging arguments with other arguments. So if we have a look at the URI up here, we've got stuff equals blah, and then all the usual paging arguments. So we just want to make sure that that picks everything apart nicely. And you can see the web API has directed it to a get method with our two arguments, one of them being stuff. Stuff's got blah in it, and paging info has blah in it. Paging information in there as we'd expect. So it manages to pick out the variables for us, even though we've sort of mixed up stuff on the query argument in the URI. Now, if we disable the model binder on there, which we'll go and do right now, just to see what happens. Global ASX. So I'll take out my model binder provider so it won't get hooked up, and we'll just see what happens. Okay, we're back in business. So I'll execute get with paging args. And we get in here and we can see that the paging info has still got page equals 2 and page size equals 40. If we have a look at the sort fields, it's actually got one sort field with a name pipe age. So the web API hasn't found a model binder. It said, hey, but in your object I can see that there's a page and page size, so let's stuff that in there for us. And it's found the sort fields in there as well and thought, well, I don't know how to split that out, but I'm just going to stuff it in there as a single string. It wasn't smart enough to know to split it out. So it did a reasonably good job, but not quite the job we were after, hence the need for a model binder in this instance. Now the final thing to note, I'll stop this again. On my paging info, I had a from URI, so I was expecting that to come from the URI all the time. So I'll also take that off and run that. And we'll do execute that same call. And if we have a look at the paging info, it's null. So it thought it was a complex object. It kind of went for that complex object and looked for it in the body, couldn't find it, so it came back with null. So providing that from URI attribute as a hint, because for this particular instance, it's always coming from the URI. Okay, back into it. Again, when you download all this, or if you happen to download all this is in there, so you can play with it to your heart's content. I originally did this presentation for DDD in Sydney, and at the time, the web API was just in RC state, so release candidate. And they did have some OData support in the web API at the time. So you could execute things like top and filter, a few of the basic queries in OData, if you're familiar with OData. However, for RTM, for actual release, they have stripped all the OData support from the web API because it was only partial. They were getting a lot of complaints that, well, you know, you don't support all the constructs and everything like that. Because of that reason, they've stripped it out and opted to utilize a NuGet package as a subsequent download to add OData support to it. Now, the NuGet package is available here. However, it is far from complete, as denoted by the alpha. And it's a little bit tricky. There's a few caveats with it. It's really not something I'd recommend using at this time. It's good to have a look at and see how they're going with it, because it's going to support the full OData spectrum, including metadata, the whole deal. However, it's not ready yet, but it will be coming soon. So I could go to the demo page and execute all these OData constructs and nothing will happen, so I'm not going to take you to the demo page. But be aware that there was previously there. So if you happen to Google for OData and Web API, you might get some mixed results because it's still relatively new. However, it's not there by default. You need a NuGet package to add to that. Okay, dependency injection. In MVC, you have this iDependency resolver interface. In the web API, you also have an iDependency resolver interface. However, while they are similar in function and spelling, they are somewhat different. You have to set up Web API separately to MVC, and the iDependency Resolver in Web API supports lifetime scopes, which I guess in simple terms allows it to deal with components that implement iDisposable, and when you've got lifetime scopes that are nested, it can group these iDisposable components in child scopes and release them more aggressively and more better manage your memory for you, as opposed to having one scope at the top of your application and all your iDisposables are related to that, that top-level scope. There is a lot of theory that goes around with that, but this is the this is one of the differences from the dependency resolver in MVC and Web API. If you're familiar with a gentleman by the name of Nicholas Blumhardt, he has actually written a blog post which goes into great detail around the benefits of lifetime scopes, and it's probably beyond my simple intellect to explain that to you. But in, again, in simple terms, it's just about managing that iDisposable reference and being able to manage that memory more aggressively for you and in a much nicer fashion. It's not very complex, but it is something that's different to MVC. And again, if you look at it first time, you think, my God, you know, it's the same bloody interface. But you're doing, you have to do something else for this one. It's a little bit disjointed. It does feel a little disjointed, but that will get better over time. I'll just show you how I've got it set up. So we've got our regular MVC registration here. But for the Web API, I'm creating what I've created here is the API Dependency Resolver class, taking in an inject kernel. And in the global configuration dependency resolver, I've set it to an instance of this API resolver. And this class itself implements iDependency Resolver, as I mentioned before. It's actually inheriting from a subclass as well, which is API Scope Container, which itself inherits implements iDependency Scope. iDependency Resolver, if we have a look at that, also implements iDependency Scope, so it's just a way of splitting that out. So you don't have to necessarily do it this way, you can implement it all in the one class. But as far as the dependency resolver is concerned, it's got a begin scope method and returns an iDependency Scope. And you can see that I'm newing up my API scope, passing in kernel begin block, and depending on your dependency injection or resolution mechanism of choice, might be AutoFAC, might be Ninject in this case, but generally, as far as I know, will support lifetime scopes, and you know, you might have a different method sitting here to start up a child scope. So that's what you put in there. Down here in the iDependency scope interface is where you've got your traditional get service and get services implementations, as well as the dispose method. So it's kind of split it out, it's made it a bit more of a meaty interface, not quite as simple as the MVC implementation, but augmented it to include support for child scopes, again, to better memory, for better memory management, particularly with iDisposables. There we go. Authentication and authorization. You have your standard authorize and allow anonymous attributes, which you do in MVC, so again, it's very similar there. But obviously with MVC, you're kind of working with you know, an authentication cookie, and it works the same way for these particular attributes. But if you don't have a site, if you're just working with an API, you've got to sort of provide some way of getting that authentication cookie in there. It's easy enough to create your own just by inheriting from action filter attribute, which is essentially what the authorize and allow anonymous attributes are. You can also use that for validation and other things like that as well. But there are a few people out there who have, I think it's an OAuth authentication attribute, which inherits from action filter attribute that they've created for the Web API. I haven't used it, but I have seen the blog post at it. If you're interested, come and see me later on and I'll find the URL for you. But when it comes to an API, all you're doing really is returning this HTTP status 401, which for a website is not so bad. It knows where to redirect you to log in and get the auth cookie and then come back and do all that kind of stuff. With an API, you don't really have that interaction. It's up to the client to sort of know what to do or know how to get past that point. You know, it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different way of thinking. So particularly when you've got the authorize and allow anonymous or authorize attribute, you have to ensure that your client will know how to sort of circumvent that and get the right authorization in place. So they're kind of the out-of-the-box stuff, the that authorize attributes. You can also choose to implement a delegating handler, which again sits fairly early up in the chain. And so we can intercept all requests, and then you can make a decision around whether to authenticate, allow in, do whatever you want. In one of the projects I've recently worked on, and that's exactly what I've done. I've used a delegating handler, and with probably one controller and a little bit of code in the back end, implemented OAuth 2, which was relatively easy. And that was the approach that we took for that one. I'll just jump into a quick demo just to show you the delegating handler approach as well as the authorized attributes. Unfortunately, it's not particularly exciting. It's either going to work or it's not. So let's just jump into the code and have a look. Test auth controller. Yep, okay. So I've got a get method with the authorize on it. And I'm not authorized, I don't have any authorization cookie. And I've got the allow anonymous on a get method that takes this auth parameter. So all this guy's going to do is this call is going to fail an authorization. If I call that up, execute that, and go down here, you can see it's got 401 authorized. I've just gone to the test auth controller, issuing a get, and so that's gone to here. Test auth controller, issued a get. Because I'm not authorized, it issued that 401 for me. However, for the call that succeeds, if you have a look up here, it goes to test auth again, but I'm putting this auth equals no thanks. And if I do that, refresh that, you can see HTTP 200 come through okay, so we've got through fine, and that's gone into that allow anonymous because we've got that auth parameter on there. Web API is directed to this method. We've got an allow anonymous on it. It allowed us in. It's all good. So that's the attributes, but if I go up here and I'm going to register a message handler, again, global configuration, can I add in a message handler for my dodgy authentication? Like with the logger, it's implementing delegating handler and overriding the send async. And all it's going to do in its extreme complexity, it's going to say, all right, if you're going to test auth handler, if it contains is glove equals true, then I'm going to let you through. Otherwise, if I'm going to not authenticate you, again, you can see the use of tasks here. We're returning a task, a brand new task that we started, and from the request we'll create a response, a string response, and we'll return the HTTP status code unauthorized. Okay, so let's do that. Okay, we've come in here. If we have a look at the URI, it's got an isGlobe equals true there, and it's allowed to go through. Okay. I'll call up that again just to make sure that I'm not lying. Okay, 200, all good. If I take that off, go to the first test, that fails, so it's going to create a new response with unauthorized on there. Come back to our browser, and you can see here we've got 401 unauthorized. So I've intercepted that request fairly early in the pipeline. And so again, that's just another way of doing it. In this instance, it's kind of my preferred approach because it's quite early in the pipeline. You don't have to, litter your code with attributes everywhere. But whichever way you choose to do it. Okay, advertising your API, having something that's self-documenting. You've got all these methods in your API and you want to provide a simple help page or something like that that details, methods you've got, what kind of HTTP access mechanisms are in place, content types, parameter types, return types, etc. So the web API doesn't give you a page that does this. It gives you an object full of metadata that then you can decide how to display it. I think with things like, if you ever used Service Stack, does anybody use Service Stack? No? Oh, one person? Yeah, so if you use that one, I think from memory, it gives you a default page of documentation for your methods. So the web APIs just said, well, we're not going to give you the default page, but we'll give you introspect all the API for you and give you all the metadata for you just to iterate over and display how you like. So what you've got is this API Explorer object. It implements iAPI Explorer. And all you have to do is ask the services for an instance of API Explorer and then start to iterate through the object. And what I'll do is we'll just have a quick look at that. I'll show you the result of that first. So we go to demo page, get help text. I'm going against an API method called Explorer, or the Explorer controller. Get help text, and you can see I've listed out, you know, the path, method, the description. In this case, I've just got a placeholder, its parameters, and it sort of goes down for all the methods that I've got. There's not much difference between this other option that I've got here, apart from this is actually an MVC page. There's two different ways of doing it. So what I've done there is we have a look at Explorer controller. I'm looking at this get API help method. So to get the Explorer, I'm looking at the global configuration, configuration services, get API Explorer. Once you've got that, it's got a list of API descriptions, and I'm doing a for each over those descriptions and picking out the things like relative path, HDB method, documentation associated with it. And similarly, I'm looping through the parameter descriptions for each one of those API descriptions and just crafting up some junky HTML to display that on the screen. So that's pretty easy. The only difference with that other method that I showed, is, I've got Explorer, where am I? API help. So this is a regular MVC controller, and all I'm doing is getting the controller from Global Configuration Services Get API Explorer and returning it to the view, and the view itself is just iterating over and deciding to what HTML to display there. So just an alternate way of doing it. The key takeaway is just getting that API Explorer and doing whatever the hell you choose with it, formatting it however you like. Now, you would have noticed that for the documentation or the description, I'm trying to get out some documentation, but it's all these placeholder elements there. The API Explorer can pick out all the technical metadata for you, but it can't get that verbose documentation for you, not without a little bit of help. So it doesn't know how to get that. It can't know that, you know, your method 123, this is my fantastic method, and in order to use this, you know, it will return some awesome foobar object. It doesn't know about that. So what you can do is implement iDocumentation Provider, pass that in to the global configuration, and whenever it asks for description about a particular API method, it will query that documentation provider, and you can provide an implementation around that. So I've done two things. I've just provided a basic implementation, which pretty much spits out that the documentation placeholder, and I'll show you where we hooked that up. So you can see here, configuration services replace type of iDocumentation provider with new custom doco provider. So it's pretty easy just to slot that in there. And I'm not doing anything special. In here, I've got two methods, get documentation that's getting a parameter descriptor, and another one's getting an action descriptor. And you can choose what you want to do there. In this particular instance, I'm not doing anything. However, let me just stop this debugging. A nice gentleman by the name of Yeo, and I think that's how you pronounce it, has created an XML documentation provider. So what it does is, and there's the URL here, it's a bit long. And what it does is it goes through and looks at the XML comments on your action methods. It will pick those out and slot them into the documentation for you. So if I run that up, go up. Yep, good. So now if I do a get help text, you can see that I've actually got some reasonable documentation in there. Now if I go have a look at that method, where was that one? Simple controller, I think. Yeah. Where's the beer one? Get me some beer. So it's getting out that comment for us there. So all you have to do is put with the help of that little component, what you always do is put XML comments on your action methods, and you'll get some nice verbose documentation out of that as well. So that's kind of handy. That's a free download. You know, you just go to this guy's blog and install it in much the same way I've done here through the global configuration services. And again, that comes through on the MVC view as well, because it's all using the same API Explorer, just so you can see that. Okay, we're almost at the end. Self-hosting. As I mentioned, web API is completely separate MVC, does not require it whatsoever. One of the benefits of that is you can host your API completely separate to MVC. You can host it in a console app, anything you like. It's pretty easy to do so. You've got this NuGet package you can store. It's been a web API self-host. It's got a HTTP self-host configuration instance, which you just new up and provide some details. You pass it off to a self-host server, open the instance, and just sit there and run. It's pretty easy. And this is one of the things that won't work on the Azure websites, because it opens it up on port 8000. If I go into the code. Right, where are we? Framework. Ah, sorry. Okay, right down the bottom here. So where I set up the self-hosted server. I'm just figuring out what my host is. I'm creating that HTTP self-host configuration, and I'm saying, all right, that's kind of its base URL. Whatever the host is, port 8000. That config that it returns, I'm going to create, do a map HTTP route, which we saw before, and just say, well, anything that goes to self-host controller is what I'll handle. And here I'm just spinning up a new task so it doesn't block this thread and therefore block my demo. Creating a new instance of self-host server, passing in this config. And we've only set up two items here, you know, the base URL and the HTTP route. Grabbing the open task, which is from the open async method of this HTTP self-host server, asking it to wait until it's all ready to go. And then I'm just entering a tight loop here so we can sit there and service requests. Remember, it's running in a separate task, so it doesn't block my main thread. And so, I open up this demo page, and so I'm going to access that simple controller that we saw at the very start where I was just posting simple arguments. So it's, instead of going to just localhost 15049, which is the web server, and I think it's simple / post get, all that kind of stuff, it's actually going to self-host, which was defined as a self-hosted server. And you can see it's actually hitting the breakpoint there for me. And it's executed the method as we'd expect, but this time the URI is the one defined by that self-hosted server. And again, this part won't work in the Azure websites. Accessing those help docs, which we just saw via the self-hosted server, because it's all in the same project and same assembly namespace. So I'm taking advantage of those controller methods which I've already worked on, but just creating a self-hosted server on port 8000 to also service those requests. So that's pretty easy. That's all you have to do is set up a self-hosted server. And all those configuration options, everything available in the standard web API is available for self-hosted service instances as well. Finally, we've got some async support. Well, when I say some async support, everything's async support. And it's really very easy. You've probably already heard about async await. Async await are two extra keywords. We're pretty lazy. We don't really need to type that rubbish in. So if I go and have a look at the demo itself is not very exciting, and it doesn't make much sense unless you see the code. So async test, I think, is the one. So my async test controller obviously inherits from API controller. The only difference it's doing is it's returning a task of string instead of, say, just a string. And what we're doing in here is I'm getting the initial task ID and setting the current thread name, And then I start a new task, and in that new task, I wait for three seconds, finds its task ID and return a string, a formatted string from that. So it's actually returning a task of type string that we've started. Okay, so we haven't, we're not returning just a string, we're not doing some synchronous behavior, we're returning it just a task of string that has an operation to execute inside of it. However, when we execute that, and it's going to execute it now, runs for 3 seconds, and it comes back with a response. It looks exactly the same as a synchronous operation. But what it's actually done is it's taken that request coming in and said, oh, hey, you've got a returning a task here, this is an async method. So it's going to execute that on a task, on a separate thread, and free up that I/O thread to go and service more requests. Once that task is finished completing, it signals the I/O completion port, and the web API will kind of synchronize that with the original request and spill back up the pipe again. So for all intents and purposes, it looks like a synchronous request. But what that means is vastly increased scalability for you. So if you've got some long-running processes, and by long-running, you know, that could be anything greater than half a second, all those I/O threads that can be serviced or that can be put into operation during that half a second or 2 seconds or 3 seconds are all free to do more work while your system is off in the background processing its work. Then when it comes back, does a little some marshalling to synchronize all that up and give it back to the user. So there's no visible difference from a consumption point of view, but in the back end, from a scalability point of view, there is a huge difference. Now, there is some, you know, you don't want to just put task of whatever on every single method. There is some marshalling that needs to happen for that magic to occur. So if your methods are quick, there's no reason to do it. You'd probably, in fact, incur an overhead. But if you've got some methods that would take, taking a second or longer, then they're probably good candidates to do that. Okay, so that's about all I have for you today. There's some resources there. The first one there is a library by ThinkTecture, which has got a whole bunch of formatters, custom formatters that you can use. There's a JSONP formatter in there. It's quite a good library. The Web API bloggers is a bunch of people who are just blogging about Web API, and there's some really smart people in there, and they've got lots of great information. The Web API demo is yourwebsites.net, you already know about, and hopefully you've had a quick look. That bottom link there is where you can get all the source code for this this whole demo. And like I said, everything's on there. It's all code. There's no database involved. All the slides are just a list of slide objects. It's very easy to run up if you've got 2012. So thank you for coming. I appreciate your attendance. I hope it's been valuable. If you've got any questions, please come up. And I've got two books. I've got some USB keys that I'll hand out. The books have absolutely nothing to do with the Web API. They do talk about practical performance profiling of .NET code. It was one of the books that I tech reviewed a while ago, and I got a few freebies. So it's not too bad. So again, thank you for coming, and enjoy the rest of TechEd.